friends. I'm Farida, the caffeine-driven host of this little submarine we call the Slow Dive podcast. My fabulous editor, Drew Francois, is joining me, and today another impactful creative is joining us. And you know what? It's not lazy, but I'm going to read from our guest's website because it resonates. Quote, "A director is a driving force behind the story that is being told. They are responsible for bringing the story to life. Orson Welles once said in an interview that directors have to be a little bit of everything, a jack of all. We will get into that. You have to know how to use a camera. You have to know acting. You have to understand music, all the different parts of a production. And doing so makes me a part of all aspects of the process." End quote. Today we have award-winning director-producer Manoj Hooda with an extensive experience in television and feature films. His most recent body of work, Heist 88, is Showtime's number one original movie of 2023, which was also nominated for 3 NAACP Image Awards. Welcome, Manoj.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Yeah. We're happy that you're here too.
That's quite an introduction.
It's on your website. It's a good introduction. I was like, why should I recreate the wheel? I'll just read it off your website, right? So let's just jump right in. So we have an icebreaker question for you today. And the first question is, what is your current read? What are you reading right now?
I'm reading a couple of things. I tend to listen to audiobooks these days, mainly because I read so many scripts. So picking up a book felt like it was tiresome, but actually now I'm getting back into reading, but picking up real books rather than off the thing. But things that I'm listening to are, as a parent, I'm listening to a very interesting book called The Anxious Generation.
Oh, yeah.
Which is like an incredible sort of compilation of like what's happened with our digital devices with regards to children since the iPhone started up in 2008-09, whenever it was. And I can tell you it's scary as hell, but it's incredibly revealing. So that's the main thing I'm reading. I'm also reading, I've been reading Obama's biography, a bit late to that, but it's been good to just remind myself of better times in politics. Yeah. But yeah, nothing fictional at the moment.
Okay, yeah. That's good. Anxious Generation. Yeah, I think even adults could benefit from reading that.
Yeah.
Second icebreaker question, what's the last album or song on repeat for you?
Well, there's a whole bunch of things from the 90s that I listen to. In fact, my car radio is also plugged into either 9 or 90s on Sirius XM. In terms of albums that I would listen to, I would say Automatically for the People, REM, or Achtung Baby, the U2. These are sort of huge albums from the 90s that I love listening to.
Yeah, those are U2, man. Timeless.
I mean, but I always listen to a lot of house music still. So I have I've recently found an Ibiza radio station on Sirius XM, so I'm constantly listening to that, and they seem to have the right kind of music on there, which is very rare to find in American radio stations. So,
okay. Our first segment is called The Creative Well from UK to US. Manoj, did you always want to make movies or did it kind of happen for you?
That's a really good question because, I grew up in a house where my mom was a big Bollywood movie fan. So there was like Bollywood music and movies around all the time, so that was obviously just kind of ingrained into me without realizing it. But and I watched a lot of TV as a kid, there's no question about it, in the UK, growing up in the UK, watched a lot of American shows and British shows. But when you're South Asian kid growing up in the UK, that is not a dream that you're even allowed to have, that you might work in it. Not that it I don't think it ever crossed my mind. It was not an idea at all for me to like, oh yeah, I'm going to go and make movies or I'm going to work in TV. It was really like, you know, I was a smart kid. I got into Oxford to study engineering. And while I was there, I started DJing. And around the same time, house music arrived in the UK. So I got very much like caught up in that whole wave that was happening. And I then decided that maybe I should just take some time out and explore what other careers I might have. And one of the things that came up was the BBC were looking for people. And so I applied and I got very, very into the whole idea of it because I watched a lot of TV and sort of felt like it's something that I knew something about, even as a young person, as a young man. And so I got an interview with the BBC, but I didn't get the job. And then after I graduated that summer, I got this work exchange visa to come to the US. And I ended up in LA staying with a friend of mine. And I got a job at the Fox TV studios on Sunset as a page. And that was my real taste of TV. I had a ball. I loved it. And still not really understanding what happens. And then made a commitment to myself that I was going to go into doing something with TV. Now, I still didn't think of myself as a filmmaker at that point. Mm-hmm. So, and also, I think I look at what was happening in the UK in the film industry and in general, I didn't feel I was inspired by what was happening at that point. I went back to the UK after being in LA and I got a job as a runner and at Sky News. And I walked into an edit suite for the first time. And that's when I was like, ah, this is where I belong because this is full of computers and machines because I had a very technical, you know, upbringing and education. But it was also where all the creative stuff happens. So I trained to become an editor and I was still doing my DJing and music stuff and then decided I wanted to work in music videos. So I started editing music videos. And then, so my focus really at that time was just to work in music videos and try and change what was happening in music videos as well. And then what happened was I came up with this idea for a music show that was based around the rave scene that was like taking off throughout the UK, but was really not being reported in any shape or form, not even on radio, not on like public radio, commercial radio, and not on TV at all. And me and my friend wrote this idea up. We were super young and somehow it got picked up by Channel 4. We sent it out, got picked up by Channel 4. They loved the idea. They gave us some money to make a pilot, like a small amount of money, just to test us out. And we came back with this incredible pilot, which blew them away. And they said, right, we're going to give you a series and you're going to direct it and you're going to produce it. So 4 years out of college, I had my own TV show as a director, not what having gone to film school. It was called Hypnosis, and I actually put up a thing about it on my Vimeo page. You'll see there's like all the episodes. I managed to get hold of them and digitize them and put them up so for people to check it out. I mean, it was a pretty intense, crazy idea, but it worked and put me on the map. And I then essentially started directing other non-scripted shows, mainly music and you know, other youth-oriented programs for Channel 4. And then I started directing music videos and commercials, which is probably where I started. That was my first time working with actors and a script. And it was actually probably my friend Tim Cole, who's my commercials producer at that time. He was probably more interested in doing film and scripted content. And so he urged us to make a short film, which I then found as a subject matter, which was ended up being Jump Boy. And it was made with Film 4 because I'd been doing all this work with Channel 4. And that was my first taste of really doing something that was like a long film, you know, something that was longer than 3 minutes or 30 seconds or a minute, you know, in terms of ads. And that film basically changed my career overnight. into scripted.
I love that. So, okay. So I got a chance because you were so kind enough to share Jump Boy. I watched it. It's your first short film, the one you're talking about for Channel 4. Where did you get the idea for it? Was it inspired by real events? It kind of felt like I felt like there was a message there, but I don't want to speak on it. So I definitely want you to share. What was the inspiration for Jump Boy?
It was written by Harsha Patel, this young girl who was also a Channel 4 sort of up and coming writer. She she'd won this competition where she came up with this idea for a documentary which had got made. So Channel 4 introduced me to her because she was writing this film script based on a true event that happened to her brother. So, and she felt passionate about it. And I remember meeting her just as a general meeting. And I read like 3 or 4 pages of the opening of this short. And I was just like, we just got on really well. And she was like, oh yeah, you're the guy who's going to make this. So, you know, we collaborated very much on developing the script. Yeah. And, you know, maybe in some ways it's dated, but at the time it was very, very fresh, maybe politically incorrect in some ways. But it was really important to her that everything in it was as it was. And you know, I think it was a really good calling card for me to arrive on the sculpted scene.
And you said earlier it was shot on 35mm. So that's even cooler because that's so generous for like a first time short film on 35. Wow. Like,
yeah. Well, it's funded by Film 4. And so they give you a budget and then you figure out what you can do with it. So, you know,
tell me about your other earlier work. I think then you went on to Kidulthood. I always want to say that.
Kidulthood was like my first feature film. And
yes.
You know, if I'm being honest, this is the thing. What my first step into narrative film and making my short film, I was really focused on that. And whether it was any good, whether I enjoyed making it. And both of those things happened. And then I had my first experience of actually taking a film to festivals and watching it with an audience. That was a bit of a game changer for me, because then I was like, this is very different to TV, where, you know, TV's nice because you do stuff, you get paid, it goes on TV, your name's on screen, and then it disappears, that's it. Whereas a film, it's like, oh yeah, it's playing here, now it's playing there, and it's playing at that festival. And you get to experience it with the audience, and you know, all over the world, and people have different responses to it. And that in itself, bizarrely, was very reminiscent of being a DJ, where you're actually playing to a live audience right in front of you and getting instant feedback. So that bug sort of came back to me.
You like the synergy of like the feedback from the audience into the performance and directing. So yeah, DJ is directing too. You're directing the crowd, the mood, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, whether it's I'm editing or whatever, you know, I'm very conscious of like, how is this playing to the audience? You know, that's what my work really is about, if there's anything to be deemed from that, regardless of the genre. I'm always thinking about how does this impact the audience and what I want them to feel. That's really the key for me. And that comes from my days of many years of DJing and playing music for crazy dancing people.
So are you DJing now, or are you picking up,
I would love to be. I can tell you that. I still have my records with me, and, you know, I'm always looking for openings to go and play my records to people.
You should. I think so. This is really interesting for a lot of us creatives to understand like how people end up in narrative filmmaking and how they get into visuals. So like what I'm gathering so far is like music was a launch pad, then directing music, which as a DJ, then the natural progression is visual storytelling. And here we are now. And you like, so what ultimately, like if you can look at your earlier works and the works now, we're going to get to Heist 88 as well. And you're on another film.
I didn't tell you about Kidulthood. So what happened?
Yes.
I lost that thread. Yeah. So this is what happened. So I made my first short film, and really, like, I wasn't really inspired to go and make a movie at that point. But I knew that, you know, with Jump Boy and my short experience, I was catching the bug of like making movies. But it wasn't until certainly British films. You know, there was lots of films from Europe and America that I loved and wanted to, but you don't see yourself making those kind of things because they're not relevant to your culture. And it was only really when, like, Danny Boyle made Shallow Grave and Guy Ritchie made Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels that the British film culture was changing. And it was now being made for an audience that I could relate to with the work that I was doing. So then I started becoming more interested in making a movie initially about, you know, that world that I brought in through non-scripted music show, trying to develop something for, you know, of that world. But it was really difficult and impossible to convince the film establishment to make something like that at that point. But me as a filmmaker, that short film got selected as one of six shorts of and filmmakers to be sort of focused on and showcased. And we were brought to New York and LA in the year 2000. And that kind of reignited my relationship with Hollywood. And I knew that my future was going to be in the US in terms of the kind of content and the kind of stories that was being told here. It was really, you know, more in line with my tastes in terms of making commercial product. And so, you know, but I knew that I probably wasn't going to get very far with just one short film or a couple of short films. I had done my first TV drama by then. I'd worked with Russell T. Davis on a show called Queer as Folk, which was my first long form, like my longest shoot, five week shoot on any project. And again, you know, I took the same kind of viewpoint, like I need to feel I'm doing good work. And I also then the final product also needs to be of a decent quality for me to pursue that. And both those things happened. I had a great time working with Russell and Nicola Schindler. And then, you know, the focus at that point really was in the 90s and the early 2000s was in making feature films, not TV. And so this thing where I got selected as one of six filmmakers out of the UK, the focus then became on me to what was going to be my first feature. And that ended up being this film called Kidulthood, which, you know, interestingly came to me via one of the actors on Jump Boy. He had started working with the writer. He'd got a regular acting job on a soap, and he'd met a bunch of other actors, and he met this guy. And so he sent me the script, and I just remember reading it. I was actually in LA at the time because I was attached to a movie here, and I was developing that. And I remember reading that going, okay, this is going to be my first movie. Or even if it's not my first movie, I'm never going to make this movie. So the film that I was attached to here didn't come together in time. I went back to the UK and yeah, took a while, but I managed to get that off the ground. But it was made independently without the support of any of the established film finance companies. So yeah, wow. It was a real grueling experience, but you know, we got it out and got there in the end.
And then you went on to Everywhere and Nowhere as well. What can you share about that film?
That's probably the only film I've made, which is kind of vaguely personal to me because it's about, but you know, it's really, a lot of things happened between my short film and my first feature film. And the main thing that happened was 9/11. Because like that changed a lot of things for Muslims and brown people in general.
Yes.
especially in film and TV. Mm-hmm. And so I was definitely, you know, I was in the rising wave and then that happened. And then I felt a big shift in what was going on. So there was, you know, a difference. And so, you know, I made Kidulthood and then I had this story that I'd been trying to tell about the double life of South Asians or any immigrants, really. They have one life they have at home and another life they have when they step out the door with their friends. And then I wanted to, you know, use that to essentially create a character who didn't want to live like that. He wanted to sort of break down that wall and be the same person on both sides of that door. And I came up with this story and developed it and, rewrote it. And again, I didn't have a lot of money to make that film, but I managed to get most of my crew back together to do it. And yeah, and, again, it was made independently and
it's a great film. Yeah.
It's a cool film, I think, and I wish it had a proper release, but unfortunately it, sometimes in the indie film world, things don't pan out the way you think they're going to.
I totally get that.
Yeah.
But Minaj, we should definitely bring that to the screens and just share that with just the indie film community here in LA. I think I really liked it. I'm just going to tell you, I think it's a really cool film. And I think more people, and I'm glad that we can access it and it's available, but I think sometimes it's nice to have retrospective because 9/11, at least for the South Asian or brown or Muslim community, it was a turning point for all of us. And I think art was the vehicle in which we were trying to express our identities, our confusion, maybe channel our angst, our uncertainty. And the funny thing is, I think that film, even now where we are politically, I think it would still connect with a lot of generations, even though it's a little bit earlier, and even in 2024. So to me, from a narrative POV, it's still very relevant and impactful. And I think it would be a great film. So definitely get your team and see if you could do a community impact screening or re-release, even locally for LA filmmakers and audience. I think there's a lot to glean from that film. Really enjoyed it, by the way.
Thank you.
Now, we're going to move on to our second segment, just because there's so much to cover here, but it's called The Future of Film and Storytelling. And I'm going to ask you, pretend you're a films here. What are your thoughts on what's happening right now with the AI tools from your POV as a director and producer and in this weird time that we're in? Do you have anything you want to share about that on record?
I'm sort of a traditionalist, I guess. And I like a lot of people who are in the business today and have been over the last 10 or 15 years or longer. We have grown up knowing what films are and how stories are told and how they connect with audiences. And I think we're kind of skeptical that AI can replace human beings in terms of, you can always look at data and you can regurgitate things that have succeeded. That is not a guarantee that things are going to succeed again. People lose interest in seeing the same kind of thing over and over again. And you need originality. And so far I don't see how AI is going to help create originality. And that's what human beings want in their stories and things that are relevant to their life. That's my biggest gripe with what's happening in general in storytelling and filmmaking today, is that there's so much crazy stuff happening in our lives at the moment, mm-hmm. and none of it exists in the most populous films or TV series that we watch. It's always about what happened 20 or 30 years ago. Everyone's looking back at these people and characters and stories. And I'm so much more interested in what's happening right now. And people just seem very afraid to bring that stuff to our screens. I don't know whether that's a corporate thing or a artistic thing, but people are afraid. They don't want to speak and talk about what's going on right now, and I find that even more weird than what's happening with AI.
No, I think you make a very salient point. I do think the stories we tell or share are reflective of what we're processing in real time in our world, whatever that world is, whether it's American viewing audience, America, or even globally. And you're right. I agree with you on that, because you have to be somewhat, yeah, I think what's happening now would be relevant, but unfortunately, what I feel like is happening is that gatekeepers / financiers and the big streamers and stuff, they have to go with the tried and true method. And so they're trying to bring back stuff that's already been popular. And I think that's the beautiful part about indie filmmaking, Minaj. Like, I think, we may or may not have the huge budgets or the Studio Marvel budgets, but it does give us our own space to like make timely, relevant films that we want to make, right? I wish more studios and that would get on that. But I think we're seeing now, I think whether you're a director or a producer, we're all struggling with the same thing. I mean, there's no shortage of talent. There is no shortage of innovative storytelling, impactful storytelling. It's just who's going to carry that torch and get it through the gatekeepers, right? And who's going to be like, yeah, I'll champion behind this film. And I think that's a discussion I don't even have an answer for myself, because I'm in it as well. So, yeah, I mean, where do you think where do you think the audience for indie films will go, Minaj, in the future?
That's a good question. I mean, I hope they stay in movie theaters first and foremost. I think, mm-hmm. I feel like that's going to be the next major change. I feel like I feel nervous that, you know, literally any day now, like, there will be no more movie theaters. Like, that will be, I mean, I just couldn't imagine that would happen in my lifetime. And now I have a fear that is going to happen in my lifetime. And if it does in the way that it may just be a reinvention, and that has to be reinvented into a different kind of business so that people can still experience that. But, I'm somebody who grew up going to the movie theater and having that experience, and that forms my intentions when I'm making films of what I want people to experience. And if that disappears, I think it already is, because people are, you know, people go to the movie theater less, they consume things on devices more. Mm-hmm. That will inform their intentions of how they tell stories in the future. And we're already seeing the shift of that, people making vertical films for their phone. You know, that's happening. That's completely new. You know, none of us would have imagined doing that, but that's going on. But that's like a first stage. And then at what point is the tipping point where you no longer, you have a set of filmmakers, the majority of filmmakers, who've never been to a movie theater. They've grown up not having been to a movie theater. So therefore, that then forms their experience of how they make their content. And then that's what people then grow up consuming. And that then sets the tone for that. So in terms of that, the indie films, you know, I think indie films may turn, like, you already have that in YouTube, really. Mm-hmm. It's the same as indie film. So it's quite a question of how YouTube morphs into smaller episodic storytelling, and which forms a bigger story, right? That's kind of, I think, where it's heading. And for indie filmmakers, it may just be a much more achievable target than waiting for years to be able to tell that one big story. You just chop it up and make the bits that you can and get it out there. And that helps you finance the next bit and the next bit, and you just carry on.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I do think handheld devices and the shorter attention spans lend more to a series development. Maybe we'll just see a whole bunch of like high value web series. And there is that's happening. We're not quite there yet, because we have streamers to contend with, which they're delivering great content as well, which I feel like, and I mean, I'm not an expert on this. This is just a discussion, but I feel like with what we've seen with the growth of streamers, that's kind of what's taken away from the theatrical releases and also the money going to that. But yeah, it's a scary thought. Like, what's going to happen if you produce a feature, let's say, that it's a passion project and you're like, okay, I want to take it to film festivals, but now I don't have theatrical release. Do I just go straight to like Hulu? Do I go straight to that? Or let's say they're not acquiring that. Where do I go now? And to me, that is a scary thought, because I think the act of actually attending a screening outside of a film festival, it's a ritual. It's more of like you're an observer, you're actually engaging and you're giving your full attention. Whereas it's that whole collective experience, which I think makes the whole cinema such a grand thing. And yeah, I don't want to see a world where we don't have that, but we got to find a way to like make films profitable for the theaters to stay open. So I don't know. I don't know what the answers are yet. But quickly, the film that you did, it's a film, Heist 88, which won a numerous award or nominated for award. Tell us about that. That's a streamer film. That's for Showtime. So how was that experience for you?
Yeah, it was an amazing experience. It was like one of the first projects where I mean, it's serendipitous because it's a true story of based on a true story, inspired by a true story that happened in Chicago in 1988. And the opening scene of the film, as I read the script, was in the Warehouse Club in Chicago with this house music DJ. And I was like, okay, I know something about this scene. I've never been there. I didn't go there, but I know all about this music and stuff. And turned out that one of the main characters was a DJ. And then that was the way into the guy who comes up with the robbery and you know, his friends work in the First National Bank of Chicago. It was a project that came to me via my manager. I went up and pitched for it. Fortunately for me, they shared my vision for the movie and I got the gig and then went through the process of making it like, it was like a TV movie, but really, we were trying to make it as cinematic as possible because you never know, you make it for a streamer and they go, oh, this is really good and we could put it out theatrically and maybe it has a different life. So unfortunately, as soon as we delivered it, we ran straight into the strikes, so none of the actors were able to promote it in the way that they would normally. I'm very proud of it. I think it's a cool little film, and I'm really hoping that I know that there's a sequel story to it that we can get to do a sequel for it.
Oh, I hope you do too. It's a great. It sounds like it's crazy how projects kind of fall together for filmmakers, serendipity. I think that's so true. You were the right person to direct it because of the house music connection. So that's kind of cool. I'm glad you were able to. And I hope there is like a part two to it. It's funny, I started off in movies of the week in Sony Pictures Television. So we did a lot of Hallmark films and Lifetime films. So I think that was before, it was a while ago, long time ago. Now I feel like streamers are that. They are movies of the week. Like there's so much, like Apple TV is doing a lot of movies. Hulu is doing that. Amazon Originals. I think that's a plus. Now, if we can also have the theater experience, that would be great, but that's a plus. It's great. There's a lot of talent. Minaj, I'm going to shift gears just for a little bit. I know we're on a project together as well. And with called Almost Home. It's a social impact, social issue film. Mm-hmm. Tell us about, and you're the director for this film. Tell us about Almost Home. How did you find out? How did you get introduced to this film?
Yeah, so I actually met Kamal through a mutual friend of ours, Jimmy Akinbola, who's a British actor. And Jimmy like put us back in touch because Kamal was trying to get this project off the ground. And he sent it to me. I read it. And I was just, there's a lot of things about it which I really liked because I'd never seen a project like this or a film like this. And I think after the experience of making Everywhere and Nowhere, I had decided to stay clear of South Asian projects and characters because I don't know, I felt like I was trying to do something that didn't get a huge amount of support from that audience, certainly in the UK anyway. And I'm very wary of that. Other things were working better for me. Mm-hmm. But this project, what I like about it is you have a Pakistani Muslim character in the center of it. And he's not a terrorist. He's not the bad guy. Not only is he a good guy, he's also, you know, prepared to make the ultimate sacrifice to fight for the United States of America. So that in itself was something I was very, very drawn to show that and tell that story. And then when I met the person that this character in this short was based on, I got very inspired because I think, you know, hopefully we can make a longer version of this story, which is actually even more amazing than the little episode that we've got in this story. So that's how it came about. And I wanted to, you know, as I've done with many writers that I've worked with, is really get into and push the writer to make something and write something that really has depth and works on the audience, as always.
Now, I know, I'm excited to see the finished product, but I have been lucky enough to see a few of some of the footage, and there is one scene I'm going to let you share how much you want to share. I don't want to give it away. It is in post-production right now. Tell us, if you like, about the desert pyrotechnic scene, because I think that's kind of cool.
Obviously the story is about a Muslim Marine who has done a tour of duty in Afghanistan and he comes back. So the main part of the story is about him dealing with this PTSD and reconnecting with his family. But there is a sequence in the film which I really wanted to push the limits on what we could achieve. And, you know, if I'm being honest, I never imagined that we would be able to get the resources to do what we did. And it was only, again, through serendipitous luck that I met a lady called Pamela Monroe when I first moved to the US when we met at the DGA back in 2017, and we stayed in touch. And I had mentioned this to her that I might be doing this. And as soon as she realized it had a military angle, she wanted to see it. And because she herself was in the Air Force, and I'd known that, but I'd never imagined that was going to affect her choice of what she would want to do. And thankfully, really for her, that she managed to pull all the resources together for us to really do this kind of a sequence. I'm very proud of it and excited to have that included in a short film like this. But hopefully that's what's going to allow us to really grab people's attention and hopefully make a longer version.
Yes, and I would like to say, being like the latest, the last person to join the film as an impact producer, I feel like, first of all, it's a beautiful film, but most importantly, it's a very nuanced story that deals with Muslim identity and PTSD, which is all very relevant. And I think even now at this time, we need to have more representation of all kinds of Muslim Americans and what they're doing, because there's so much like Islamophobia and anti-Muslim hate, but also veteran stories. There's a shortage of that, and they do make the ultimate sacrifice. All veterans do. And so I really like the message behind the film. I'm really happy that you, Pamela, Sadia, and Kamal, all you guys are banded together to do this. And I really can't wait to share this film with the world. So thank you, Minaj, for sharing that. Our final segment is called Collaboration and Community in Filmmaking. So film is a collaborative venture, as we know. It's kind of mystical. We're building a reality from initial log line to the end product on screen. How can we be better filmmakers? How do you stay creative between projects as a director? Do you have any insight for emerging directors?
Like I said, I'm really inspired by what's happening in our world, like the good and the bad. And so that's, I watch a lot of news for a start. But I think I also look at the way films are made has really impacted the strength of the storytelling, like probably in a negative way. I think the more sort of gimmicks and tools that we have, the less we pay attention to how strong the story is. So I've enjoyed recently going back to some of my favorite films from the 90s and 80s and seeing how they hold up to view today. And they're still pretty good. And in terms of creativity, you can still learn a lot. Especially like, you know, I'm someone who grew up shooting film and understands what you can and can't do with that. And experimented a lot with that kind of stuff in making music videos. And I love to incorporate some of that in my present day work, but it's not easy. You know, it's to emulate that with the digital is not straightforward at all. And it takes a lot of time and money to try and do that. So that's what I would encourage people to do, is to actually go back and look at some of those films. And
digital filmmaking and videography has made it easy to access, but the old school way of using like 16 or 35, where you actually had to know, use your lighting meter and get the angles right and make sure your colors were fine and the shadows were working, because it was so costly, right? And I don't know, I did my first film on 16 millimeter, and I can tell you it's not on IMDb because it's an old ass film, but it was a different experience. We had to send it to the labs, to Kodak, to have it processed and then like cut and splice it. Like, I'm like, and now everyone's making films, but what I feel, I'm trying to recreate that celluloid analog look using digital. So at least, and I haven't figured it out yet, so I might pick your brain about it at some point, because I don't know how to do that yet, where I can get the vibe of the earlier, because I just felt like even horror, any genre, even those like foggy dramatic films just looked better on film, but that's so expensive now. And I think if we really want to challenge young storytellers or emerging storytellers to really understand composition and craft, give them film. They'll be very, very careful and very intentional, right? Because it's so expensive to shoot with film. So anyways, sidebar. One last thing before we close out our interview, since we're talking about community and filmmaking, do you have any, how do you build your teams when you're like crewing up on projects? What are some great, things to consider when you're working and collaborating? What kind of crew members do you look for? And also, how do you handle creative differences on projects? Just any insight to...
I think, you know, as you get to a certain point in your filmmaking journey, you collect a set of people that you know and trust and are going to make your life easier and straightforward, so you don't have to build a new relationship. I think I've found that. So, you know, the people that I work with on Heist 88, the people that I work with on this, in terms of the composer and the DP. And, you know, probably the next film I'll do, it'll be the same sort of mix of people, because you know that they know what you want and they understand what you're looking for. And in terms of, you know, but I'm obviously always open to working with people that have done much bigger things than myself. And there are lots of DPs that I look at the work of and be like, yes, I want my film to look like that, so I would love to work with that person. And or an editor that I've seen the work of, I'm like, yeah, I'd like to work with that person. But you know, that's also a different ball game that happens, you know, as you climb up the ladder of different kinds of movies. But right now I feel like I'm in a good place where I have a certain level of talent that I have access to. So what you don't want to do is work with somebody who's like way bigger than you in terms of, or higher up on the scale than you. So then the power shifts, like they have more, more draw towards the producers or whatever, then you kind of can lose control of that. And I wouldn't want to find myself in that situation. Like, I would only work with somebody who I felt was really interested. And, you know, I have, so my first short film and my first feature film and Everywhere and Nowhere was shot by a DP called Brian Tufano, who was essentially the only kind of mentor I've ever had in my whole career, whether it's TV or film or music or anything. And he's the one who really encouraged me to have an understanding of what he called the visual narrative, and also to push those boundaries. And I've always carried that with me. I mean, sadly, he passed away last year. So he, you know, and, you know, so he won't be able to collaborate with him further on that. And, but he definitely has made an impression on me and gave me the right sort of suggestions to go on and take that to my next projects. And now, in terms of having creative differences, I think I've definitely learned after all these years of how to try and get the best out of people and not to alienate them. You know, always consider people's ideas and suggestions, because, you know, it's up to you whether you accept them or not. You know, it's going to still have your name on it as a director. You can claim all the credit for all these great ideas, and but, you know, be open to something being better. And if it's not, then you have to be able to articulate exactly why that's the case and do it and without offending people.
I love that. So, well, one really quick question, and then we're going to have our reflective question at the end, and we're almost done. Is there a project you want to work on? What kind of movie would be your ideal project that you would like to work on? Is there someone you'd like to work with or a project you'd like to work on? If you could put it out there in the universe, what would that be?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to do like an action thriller, like a big one. And I have a small one that I'm trying to get off the ground right now. I would say it's more of a thriller than an action. I mean, there's bits of action in it, but it's not really like an action thing. But, you know, one of my all-time favorite films was Training Day, by Antoine Fuqua, which Denzel Washington won the Oscar for. That and the early Luc Besson films are like some of my favorite films that I would love to be working on those kind of films. And my favorite director of the sort of biggest body of work, I would say, is a British chap called Tony Scott, who is the younger brother of Ridley Scott. And invariably, all the films I watched of his, I absolutely loved. And so, you know, now that he's gone, I'm dreaming of maybe taking over from where he left off. And bringing those kind of projects to the screen. I love
that. Well, hopefully, inshallah, it'll happen one day, right? You'll be doing that. Well, Manoj, this was a great conversation. Before we go, we have a reflective question for you. And so the question is, if you could go back in your life, what age and place would you revisit and why?
I would definitely go back to the 90s and just put that on a loop and stay there before the arrival of broadband internet and the cell phones and the smartphones and all that. Because I think we had it pretty good at that time with the music and the films and, you know, all that cultural stuff that was happening.
Yes. Good. What is home to you?
Wow, that's a good one. Home. Well, London's always going to be my hometown. Even though I'm living here, this is becoming more of my home. But yeah, I miss like spending time in the UK and especially in London. And hopefully I'll get to do some more films over there. But for the time being, I'm going to be here and see how far I can push the boundaries for myself and what I can achieve.
Wonderful. Well, all right. Thank you so much for joining us today. I think our listeners really appreciate all the insight. And I really, I'm going to link all your films and your website to our podcast episodes. So everyone can check out Everywhere and Nowhere and Kid Adulthood and Heist 88 and follow you on your Instagram and your website. And We want to see all your films, Minaj. I think it's going to be great. And I'm excited for Almost Home and see what comes of that. I think it's going to be wonderful. But thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
If you enjoyed The Slow Dive, please subscribe and leave us a positive review wherever you get your podcasts. The Slow Dive is hosted by Farida Rafiq, edited by Drew Franzblatt. Our theme song is Dive by Sarah. Thanks for listening.